Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline across the top of the page, UNC Chapel Hill moving Carolina North forward. And right under that on the left side, there's a picture of a man standing outside of a building. The caption reads, Gordon Merkline heads up facilities for UNC Chapel Hill. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Chapel Hill. After more than a decade of planning and traversing various minefields, including concerns about traffic and a horrendous economy, construction may finally be on the horizon for UNC Chapel Hill's much-debated Carolina North satellite campus. The university has issued a call to design firms interested in drawing up advanced plans for what would be the campus's first building, a $65 million, 225,000-square-foot research center. With the construction industry in a state of virtual depression, an August 2nd meeting to discuss the request for proposals, or RFPs, attracted more than 200 design firm representatives, according to one participant. This project will draw intense interest from across the USA, says Pat Perkins, an associate with the O'Brien Atkins Associates architecture and engineering firm in Durham, who was at the meeting. The winner of the advanced planning design project, which has been estimated to be worth $6 million, would be expected to take the first spot in line to work with the university's facility planning division through full design and construction of the Carolina North building. And depending on the success of the first building, the firm could be in prime position for future projects at Carolina North, which in its first phase is envisioned to be a 228-acre satellite campus with up to 3 million square feet of space for academics, offices, research, housing, and retail. This is the first building we expect to break ground on at Carolina North, and everyone is excited about it, says Gordon Merkline, Executive Director of Real Estate Development for the university. We think it's going to be a catalyst to get things going. Planning for Carolina North has been going on for more than a decade. UNC Chapel Hill officials and Chapel Hill town leaders reached a development agreement in July 2009 that set the development and design guidelines for the first phase of the project. The first phase would encompass much of the 133 acres of land formerly occupied by the Horace Williams Airport that closed in July. That land is west of the intersection of Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and Estes Drive. While university leaders are moving ahead with design work, finding funding for construction has forced them to think creatively. Already, all state-funded construction plans at UNC have been put on hold because of cuts in funding by the General Assembly. And private developers, such as Alexandria Real Estate Equities, have given up on plans to build at Carolina North due to the slowdown in commercial markets. The university is turning to what's called a self-liquidating model for the first building, where space will be rented to university-affiliated groups currently leasing off-campus space. Merkline says those rentals represent about 400,000 square feet of space around the triangle. Another source of revenue could come from research grants, which generally include provisions for overhead costs, including rental payments. Merkline says no general funds from the state nor tuition proceeds from students would be used to build it. Instead, bonds secured by projected rental proceeds would be issued. Groups affiliated with the provost's office, the vice chancellor for research's office, and the School of Public Health are expected to be among the first occupants of the building. But Merkline says it's yet to be determined which research groups and which offices will be moved. The deadline for design firm proposals for the advanced planning project is August 15. A short list of design teams will be selected on August 22nd, according to a copy of the proposal. The university's Board of Trustees will make the final design firm selection at its meeting on September 21. At the design firm pre-proposal meeting, almost 140 people filled in the sign-in sheet, says Diane Gillis with the UNC Chapel Hill Facilities and Planning Department. But Perkins says the number of participants was closer to 200 people, representing many firms from many regions of the county, including people she met from New York and Kansas. In a nutshell, the environment for architecture and engineering projects is extremely competitive, Perkins says. And moving down from that article, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, This next article is in the center of the page. It has a black border around it. And inside that border at the top, first in bold black letters, "Gig goes the internet. Triangle universities get in line for ultra high speeds." And then under that, the article starts. But then under the article, there's also a picture of a man wearing a suit and tie, sitting at a desk in his office in front of his computer. The caption reads, "NC State's Mark Hoyt thinks the triangle has an inside track." And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Research Triangle Park. Technology leaders in the triangle are boosting GigU, the mod name given to an effort to establish a 1 gigabyte internet connection that's as much as 400 times speedier than the current fastest networks. Their selling point? Economic development. "This is really enhancing our innovation ecosystem to attract new companies," says Chris Mulder, Director of Marketing for the Research Triangle Foundation, which manages Research Triangle Park. "There could just be a huge influence for this region." The technology of a 1 gigabyte internet exists, but GigU needs buy-in from a private internet provider to make an investment of tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars. Providers have not made that move because they do not know if they will have the customer base to make it work financially. "If there are profits to be made today, this would already be happening," says Blair Levin, executive director of GigU and a fellow at Washington, D.C.-based Aspen Institute. "That's where GigU comes in. You have to figure out how do you get the buy side and sell side together," Levin says. Those involved in GigU think the triangle is well positioned as a front runner to receive widespread access to the high-speed network. With a high concentration of tech and medical companies that would benefit from such access, an internet provider might realize a mature market in only a few months, says Mark Hoyt, NC State University Vice Chancellor of Information Technology. "I would think that our community is one of the areas that has the highest opportunities for success," he says. If that were to happen, Levin says, it would take the economic potential of the triangle to a new level. "There is a tremendous public benefit of having these advanced networks," Levin says. "If you take advanced networks from universities and bring them into the community, there's a lot of potential for innovation and potential for economic growth." In addition to NC State, Duke University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill have joined the 29-member GigU. They hope their strength in numbers approach attracts attention to the triangle. Hoyt likened the GigU effort to the Groupon of high-speed internet. "If enough people sign on, a private internet provider will see the benefit. The first step for GigU is to solicit requests for information from any internet provider that might be interested in pursuing the project to give the group an idea of what providers would want. After that, they would move to a request for proposals where providers get serious and lay out what it would take to make the dream a reality. So far, the industry has been supportive of the idea, but has not given much in the way of details. Our companies welcome new ideas like GigU to create test beds for the development of next-generation applications," says Walker B. McCormick, Jr., president and CEO of U.S. Telecom, a national association of broadband providers. When asked about the costs, representatives of U.S. Telecom said they didn't have firm numbers. Industry representatives, as well as those involved in GigU, acknowledge that cost is the main question to be answered. They say one of the main purposes of the group is to determine if the returns would make the investment worthwhile. And moving just to the right of that article, there's an article that runs vertically along the right side of the page. The headline, "Shower of Beds Okayed for Wake." This article is written also by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. And then under the article, there's a picture. And it's a picture of an elderly man in a rocking chair and a younger lady who looks to be maybe a nurse speaking with him. The caption reads, "Demand is growing for nursing care." Of 330 additional nursing home beds being allowed by state regulators this year across North Carolina, 240 are going to Wake County, evidence of pent-up demand and an increasingly aging population. A lot of the need has to do with the massive growth in this County in particular, says Patrick Baker, a nursing home planner with the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. By 2014, a projected 92,127 of Wake County's residents will fall in the 65 and older category, making up 8.9% of the county's total population. That includes 10,897 residents age 85 years or older, estimates DHHS. To help control healthcare costs, the DHHS Division of Health Service Regulation determines the need for healthcare services, including nursing beds, and providers must file a certificate of need application when seeking to expand services. Per the DHSR formula, Wake County will need 2,617 nursing beds by 2014. That means 269 more than the 2,348 currently spread across 25 facilities. Although that need was recognized, the DHSR did not initially make any new beds available for Wake County this year because Wake's facilities were at 85% capacity as a whole, not the 90% capacity required to trigger a notice for more beds. Upon further analysis, however, underutilization of some facilities was found to be artificially bringing down the overall occupancy rate. If the three facilities with the lowest occupancy rates were eliminated, the utilization rate rose to 90%, leading Brookdale Senior Living to petition the DHSR for 240 beds in Wake County. Other nursing home operators may also petition for the beds, but most must do so by an August 15 deadline. These chronically underutilized facilities may never be preferred by patients, yet their low utilization rates prevent the development of additional nursing beds in Wake County, wrote Brookdale in its application. Further, Brookdale believes it is unfair to effectively force the residents of Wake County to either utilize these facilities that they clearly do not want to use or seek care in other counties. Todd Kastner, Brookdale Senior Vice President for Corporate Planning, would not comment on the petition or CON application because he said it could be interpreted as lobbying, for which he or Brookdale could face a reprimand from the state. Found to be the three lowest capacity nursing homes in Wake County are the Cypress of Raleigh, City of Oaks Health and Rehab, now Tower Nursing and Rehabilitation, and Capital Nursing and Rehab. The Cypress was at only 23% utilization, but that was in part because it was in a ramp-up period for newer facilities, according to the Brookdale petition. Representatives of the three facilities did not return phone messages requesting comment. The new beds coming available are a sign of how care must be provided to an aging population that is living longer, says Peggy Smith, Executive Director of the North Carolina Assisted Living Association. Smith predicts the number of people with dementia will triple by 2020, another reason why all types of assisted living or nursing care facilities will grow in demand. Nursing homes provide 24-hour-a-day care. They are one step below hospital care and can cost residents as much as $60,000 a year or more, says Smith. Other types of assisted living facilities do not provide the same level of service, though they are moving in that direction. We are serving higher acuity levels than ever, Smith says. Depending on care provided, assisted living facilities costs can run from $3,000 a month to $5,000 a month, Smith says. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. And this article runs horizontally across the bottom of the page with a dark olive background color. The headline, Cardinal Bank Parent Tweaks Mortgage Unit Lays Off 100. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Durham. In a cost-cutting action, Yadkin Valley Bank, which owns the Cardinal franchise in Durham, is consolidating branches and restructuring its mortgage business, which is branded SIDUS Financial. That's S-I-D-U-S. Licensed to operate in more than 20 states from Mississippi to New Hampshire and based in Greenville, North Carolina, SIDUS has pulled the plug on its wholesale and correspondent lending operations, shuttering three out-of-state regional offices and eliminating nearly 100 full-time employees, according to bank CFO Jan H. Holler. A portion of the staffers were retained in commission-only positions at SIDUS, as Citus will continue accepting applications for reverse mortgages. The impact of the restructuring on CITUS offices in Raleigh, Fuquay-Varina, and Rocky Mount is not known at this point. In North Carolina, CITUS operated out of 9 offices in all, including locations in Wilmington, Hickory, and Asheboro. As for the bank, Yadkin branch closings have totaled 5 to date, none in the Triangle, with 3 more expected in the third quarter. The cuts are part of the bank's no pain, no gain strategy to, quote, show a profit in the third quarter and moving forward, unquote. CEO Joseph Towle told analysts in a recent conference call, hurt by the real estate downturn, Yadkin Valley chalked up losses of $74 million in 2009, but was able to show a profit of $1.4 million in 2010. In the second quarter of 2011, losses rose again to $20.9 million, nearly $15 million of which was due to one-time write-downs on the CITUS restructuring and on a tax-related matter. In a step to preserve capital earlier this year, Yadkin suspended dividend payments to the U.S. Treasury on the $49 million in taxpayer funds it received back in 2009 under the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. Looking down the road, Towle says bank managers have started to see Yadkin's non-performing loans declining quarter after quarter. Yadkin Valley Bank purchased CITUS back in 2004. Wholesale mortgage lenders provide mortgage packages to brokers who then make retail transactions. Correspondent mortgage lenders originate and fund loans in their own name, then sell them off to larger mortgage lenders who in turn service them or sell them on the secondary market. Sam Garcia, publisher of Dallas, Texas-based MortgageDaily.com, says he is not shocked by Yadkin's exit from the wholesale side of the business. Rules changes and better returns on the retail side of the mortgage business these days would be just two of the motivating factors. And if they are trying to clean up the bank, they may not consider the mortgage paper being generated by the brokers they have been working with as good as the paper they are generating on their own, he adds. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column, the headline that starts it off. NCSU Research gets green help at K-Town campus. Under that, there's a picture of a row of greenhouses taken at dusk with their lights on, and you can see the plants inside. The caption reads, "Greenhouses such as these will help NCSU researchers do their plant work." North Carolina State University is moving forward with building up its research infrastructure at the North Carolina Research Campus in Kannapolis, near Charlotte, bringing online 3 greenhouses at a cost of $250,000. The greenhouses will be instrumental to work conducted at NCSU's Plants for Human Health Institute at the campus, says Tara Voglin, the Institute's Director for Business and Research. The Institute is part of the 350-acre Life Sciences Hub, which focuses on health, nutrition, and agriculture. The NC State operation studies plants to identify traits and characteristics that could affect human health. For example, that could mean developing a better-tasting strawberry, says Jeremy Pattison, NC State's strawberry breeder. All well and good, but it's hard to imagine a better-tasting strawberry than the one out of Biz's garden this spring. Oh no, inflation has hit Snoopy's hot dogs. Biz dropped by this fave lunch spot to take advantage of Snoopy's Tuesday 99-cent hot dog special recently, only to find out the price had been raised by 26 cents. However, in full disclosure, the $1.25 per dog price is still a deal because they normally sell for $2.09. So Biz bought a couple of dogs and paired them with an order of fries. The meal was still less than $5, which satisfied the belly and the wallet. You can drop by and get the hot dog special on Sundays and Tuesdays, 5 Triangle locations to choose from. Just be sure to carry an extra 26 cents per dog nowadays. Eye Contact is making good on its aim of becoming a socially responsible company. The email marketer showed some interesting stats recently in its inaugural Corporate Social Responsibility Report for 2010. The company launched its 4 Ones volunteer and charitable program and became a certified B Corp last year. In 2010, Eye Contact donated almost $150,000 to charity, Its employee energy consumption was reduced by 11%, and it offset 51% of its CO2 emissions in terms of direct and indirect emissions. It didn't quite reach other goals, such as giving away 1% of its product to North Carolina nonprofits. The company gave away 0.3%. But tucked into the report was also this stat. iContact posted $38.6 million in revenue for 2010, up 35% from 2009. Not bad going for 2010 overall. When former Wake County Commissioner's Chairman Gary Pendleton paid a visit to the Wake County Health and Hospitals Board meeting on August 2nd, he came with a joke to be played on WakeMed CEO Bill Atkinson. Pendleton, who once served on the WakeMed board, was greeted as a special guest to discuss Atkinson's attempts to purchase crosstown competitor Rex Hospital from UNC Healthcare. A retired Army general, Pendleton rose to present Atkinson a trophy with a faux hand grenade on top for his assault on Rex Healthcare. Known for speaking his mind and a biting humor, Pendleton characterized Atkinson's initiative in war terms, calling it a frontal assault, a flank, and even an attack from the rear in the battle to gain control of Rex. You name it, he said, as board members chuckled. Greensboro-based Bell Partners spared two Triangle properties when it recently sold nearly all of its senior living portfolio to Senior Housing Properties Trust for $300 million. The sale includes 10 North Carolina properties, one in Durham, but two in the Triangle were spared, Alta Walk in Durham and Alta Oak Ridge in Raleigh. Company President John Bell told the Business Journal of the Triad that those facilities were not fully leased and he expects to sell them within the next 2 years after they are full. SNH owns $3.8 billion worth of primarily senior living properties, including 27,000 residential units in 36 states. Besides the North Carolina properties, the Bell sale includes 6 properties in South Carolina, 6 in Florida, 2 in Virginia, and 2 in Georgia. Young Jesse Duncan had to make a trip with his family to Durham for a checkup at Duke Children's Hospital in July, and a side visit to the Bull City's Museum of Life and Science turned out to be the highlight. While sitting through the museum's fossil dig site, where dirt from fossil-rich Lee Creek and Aurora is shipped in, the 7-year-old happened upon something he knew, as only a kid can, was special, reports the Durham Herald-Sun. He thought it was the tooth of a devil ray, but it turned out to be more special than that. The fossil ultimately was identified as a symphysial cow shark's tooth, estimated to be 10 million to 15 million years old. Museum staffers say it was amazing to find such a treasure, but even more amazing was that it was virtually intact. The Duncans have been offered as much as $400 for the tooth, but young Jesse's keeping it, though he did volunteer to lend it to the museum so other children could learn from it, he says. Otherwise, it'll be in a safe deposit box. The third annual Downtown Raleigh Restaurant Week is set for August 22 through 28. Each year, restaurants that sign up offer 3-course prefix meals or dinners for $20 or $30, depending on venue. Added this year will be 3-course beer or wine pairings for an additional $10. Cuisines available include Turkish, Japanese, Italian, Spanish, and Lebanese, among others. As a charter Downtown Raleigh Restaurant Week participant, we have been delighted to see the growth of this event in terms of the number of participating restaurants and number of diners supporting the local, downtown local, independent food and beverage scene, Tanya Andruzik of Solas in Glenwood South says. It's known as the pace of play in golf, meaning how long it takes to play a round. Depending on a course's length, a foursome typically should be able to complete 18 holes in 4 to 4.5 hours. A big bugaboo and upsetting pace of play is the phenomenon of lost balls. The PGA has a tournament limit of 5 minutes to search for a lost ball. If that time is allowed for weekend duffers and, say, a foursome collectively loses 5 balls during a round, well, that adds 25 minutes. All of this is a way of explaining the job of a four-caddy in golf. They don't carry clubs, rather they stay ahead of a group or alternately are positioned on certain holes with the duty of spotting balls for players so no time is lost looking for them. Chip Watson, general manager of the Lonnie Pool Golf Course on NC State University's Centennial Campus, has partnered with First Tee of the Triangle in a program in which the First Tee volunteers are placed on specific holes to serve as four caddies. In an experimental trial of the program, pace of play was cut by 15 minutes. First Tee is a nonprofit organization that partners with golf courses to offer instructions to kids who otherwise would never have a chance to play the relatively expensive game of golf. Watson says the four-caddy program is something we've been looking into for a while, and we couldn't think of a better organization to partner with to bring this to fruition. I believe our golfers and our course will benefit greatly. In an effort to raise some money for the four-caddy and other programs for the upcoming year, First Tee officials are conducting a raffle with a first prize of a trip for four to play Pebble Beach. Tickets are $100 each. For more info, go to thefirsttee-triangle.org. Wake Technical Community College will host a STEM, STEM conference for community college faculty this fall. BIS regards STEM courses, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics as the wave of the future. The opportunity for Wake Tech came with some help from IBM, which offered a $10,000 grant to the college to develop its STEM programs. IBM initially intended the grant for Wake Tech only, but every other year the North Carolina Community College Faculty Association holds a conference. Wake Tech leadership decided to not only further develop its own faculty, but those of other colleges as well. We said, wouldn't it be great if we could do it then? So we did, says Tanya Forbes, Wake Tech Dean for Math and Science. The conference will be October 9 through 11 in Research Triangle Park. Contributing to BIS were staffers Cameron Snipes, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Monica Chen, and Jason DeBrun. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to has the headline, Costs Keep Rising in Medicaid Transition. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. And it also has a picture of a man speaking at a conference wearing a suit and tie. The caption reads, Lanier Kanzler heads up DHHS. After nearly 7 years and $78 million spent on the effort, North Carolina's new computerized Medicaid claims processing system still isn't operational. In fact, the company now doing the job, Falls Church, Virginia-based Computer Sciences Corporation, or CSC, the second major IT contractor to have a go at it, has just received a 22-month extension from federal overseers, adding another $156 million to the cost of setting up the system. Changes to Medicaid rules and the contractor's reliance on computer code written for a job in another state are among factors being blamed for the delay. Under the original timetable, CSC was to have started processing claims this month. Now, that might happen on July 1, 2013, the new go-live date. Total project costs, meanwhile, have risen from the $351 million range to $507 million, of which the federal government is picking up 80%, according to federal documents. The price tag for the CSC contract to administer the program, once its system is up and going, rises from $278 million to nearly $495 million. The delay represents the latest chapter in a saga that goes all the way back to the early 2000s, when the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, told North Carolina to rebid the work that at the time was being handled by Plano, Texas-based EDS, which is now part of Hewlett-Packard. The state's first effort to comply came in 2004. Dallas, Texas-based ACS, now part of Xerox, outbid EDS to win a contract worth $171 million annually, only to have the job canceled 2 years later following a dispute with officials at the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. ACS sued and collected nearly $11 million. The next rebid came in 2008, when CSC outbid EDS by $22 million. All the while, EDS, HP, had gone on processing claims and now will continue to do so into 2013. It's no small job. Some 1.3 million North Carolina residents receiving medical help under the state federal Medicaid program submit millions of claims each year worth $10 billion. Processing the claims involves putting in miles of computer code, and recent state and federal program changes have necessitated code alterations or additions that account for 12 months of the 22-month delay. Yes, those are two of the factors, says Brad Dean of DHHS, the agency that administers the program. 6 months of the delay are due to what one state document calls schedule slippage. CSC, the DHHS document says, believed it could use 73% of the code it had developed for similar work in New York, one of its other Medicaid states, but only 32% of it actually worked in the Tar Heel state, the document adds. Imperial Capital analyst Michael Kim, who covers CSC, says the company did $16.1 billion in revenue over the past year and has not brought up the North Carolina contract situation as a material event. The only contract they've talked about recently is one they have in the UK to work on the National Health Service, he says. Officials at CMS, who granted the 22-month extension in July, continue to be upbeat about the project. Approval of the state's extension request, the agency's district administrator, Jackie Glaze, wrote to the state, indicates CMS' continued support for the project and its confidence in its return on investment. And our next article is right in the middle of the page. It has a black border around it. Within that border, at the top, it says, home resales outpacing new home sales. And then under that, there's a picture of a woman standing at what seems to be her front door, holding a new, what looks to be a close to newborn baby and a small child. The caption reads, Kim Kunz at home with her two youngsters. Then under that, there's the headline in bold black lettering, Existing Homes Rule. And then the article under that. The article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the dateline of Raleigh. When Nick and Kim Kunz relocated to the Triangle last spring, the couple toured several new home communities looking for the right home for them and their two children. Ultimately, the Kunzes, like many other families shopping for homes in a suppressed housing market, decided to buy an existing home instead of a newly built one. We just thought it would be a better investment to do a home that was already established, says Kim Kunz, noting that her family expects to move again in 5 years to follow her husband's next military assignment. Our realtor didn't say we shouldn't, but said in the long run, it would be better not to do a new house. Data show the Kunzes are not alone in choosing used over new. For much of the past decade, new home builders delivered between 37% and 41% of all home sales recorded in the six-county area of Wake, Durham, Orange, Chatham, Johnson, and Franklin counties. That was about 2.5 times the national average, says Tom Anhut, a group president for national luxury home builder company Toll Brothers. The new home market share since has plummeted and now stands at less than 30% of all home sales. The trend is reflected in prices. The average price for a resale home in the Triangle has almost returned to the market's peak level of $234,000, reached in 2007. However, the average price for a new home in the Triangle continued to decline from a peak of $297,000 in 2008 to less than $271,000 in the first half of 2011, according to Market Opportunity Research Enterprises of Rocky Mount, a residential market research firm. The press keeps telling everyone how great the Triangle is, Forbes number one, when in actuality, we're simply the best of the worst, Anhut told the gathering of real estate and business leaders at a July 28 forum on the market. Raleigh real estate veteran Jim Allen of Coldwell Banker, Howard Perry and Walston's, the Jim Allen Group, says buyers are having to buy resale houses because the inventory of homes at most price points has dropped to under a 6-month supply. In neighborhoods where I used to have 7 or 8 speculative houses, I maybe have 1 listed now. Many of what once were the Triangle's busiest new home builders, St. Lawrence Homes, Perry Builders, Anderson Homes, Orleans Home Builders, have either gone out of business or are building a small percentage of homes they were building at the housing market's peak in 2005 and 2006. Allen blames the banks that won't approve construction loans for local builder projects. So it falls to publicly traded national builders like Pulte Homes, MI Homes, Toll Brothers, and Lennar to build new inventory. These builders thus have been able to increase their market share and in the process provide some stability for the new home market. MI Homes ranked number 10 among the Triangle's largest residential builders in 2008, but rose to number 2 in 2009 by building 94 homes, a meager number compared to better times, that year, according to Triangle Business Journal research. We're based in Ohio, and when we look at where we want to put our dollars and where it makes the most sense, a lot of our emphasis has been put on Raleigh, says Ed Christensen, Raleigh Division President for M&I Homes. There's just not much going on in the Midwest or in Florida. Christensen says he tries to keep an inventory of 5 or 6 homes available for walk-up buyers in each of M&I's homes, 10 communities in the Triangle. A lot of the market is inventory sales, and you've got to be able to stick your neck out and take some risk, and hope you get rewarded for that. Jim Allen says he has tried to make up the difference in the loss of new home inventory with resale homes that have been reconditioned to like new. We've had to learn new ways to do business, he says. If there was a house that needed a lot of work, I used to not take that listing versus spending a month and a half getting it ready to sell, but I'm doing it now because I think it's necessary. Allen says a seller can spend between $2,000 and $12,000 replacing a home's carpet, hardware, and countertops, but they can usually make up most of that cost with a quick sale. Our buyers are spoiled, and no matter the price point, they all want something new. We all want something nicer than what we're trying to move out of. TBJ News intern Olivia Barrow contributed to this report. Unable to make it pay, owner closing Carrboro incubator. That's the headline on our next story. The subheadline, as facility is shuttered, new space for startups is being planned by Brad Gibson in Chapel Hill. And this article is written by Olivia Barrow with the Dateline of Raleigh. Entrepreneurship in Carrboro is losing one of its biggest supporters with the closing of Carrboro Creative Coworking, which is scheduled for September 30. Owner Brian Russell, a social entrepreneur himself, is closing the shared office space because the business failed to reach profitability after 3 years. Russell says he would like to try to open a co-working space again, perhaps in Durham, but with more partners and a mission-based model instead of a for-profit model. The further it goes into the for-profit, the more it's like an office suite, he says. You'll price out people who want to start from the ground floor. Russell tried to keep his prices low enough to lure people out of the coffee shops and dining room tables into either his private offices or shared common areas, where they had access to high-speed internet and free coffee all day, every day, but he said his space just wasn't big enough to turn a profit. His closing opens up an opportunity for Brad Gibson, owner of Entrepreneurs Exchange Carolina, located near Chapel Hill's police department, who is planning to renovate one of his buildings into a co-working space. At $100 per month, Gibson's advertised prices are about one-third what was charged at Carrboro Creative Coworking. Since Gibson owns the building, he can offer the services less expensively. He says he has signed a lease for the building's first tenant. If I had a mortgage, I couldn't do it at that price point, he said. Gibson hopes to open his co-working space by October 1, allowing for a smooth transition for Russell's tenants who want to continue using a co-working space. Among them is Harry Park, who runs a one-man show called Lynx Logic Incorporated. The co-working setup worked well for him, Park says, giving him a productive workspace and allowing him to make useful business connections. There's a lot of cross-pollination there, he says. People get hired from when they were working in the big room by the companies they were sitting next to. Park and his roommate from Carrboro Creative Coworking are moving to Gibson's building, hoping to start a business together in the future. I think it's great for startups and solopreneurs to have that kind of environment and working with people who have similar ideas and similar goals, Park says. Park believes local governments in Carrboro and Chapel Hill need to take steps to create a vibrant startup culture. The value of incubators like Carrboro Creative Coworking is evidenced by the success stories Russell can tell from his 3 years on running the operation. I did a survey a while back about the amount of, and what things the customer spent on local businesses when they were here, he says. It was really significant. That equals sales tax, which helps the town. Colin Copeland and Tobias McNulty, co-founders of Cactus Consulting, can tell their own co-working success story. They started a web development business in August 2009 and moved into Russell's space. They started a web development business in August 2007 and moved into Russell's space in 2009. Soon afterward, they began to hire employees and found the flexibility in the co-working space invaluable. It was our dream environment to move into, McNulty says. They afforded us a shorter lease term, which allowed us to grow more easily than a space that would require a 2 or 3 year lease. Cactus grew out of the co-working space into an empty office next door in October, where they now employ 10. In our economy, we're learning we need to support people at any income level, Russell says. You can't just be supporting people who already have things going on and just say good luck to the others. Employers begin hiking pay by a tad again, survey finds. That's the headline on the next article written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. To those who are working more for the same pay, take heart. Data indicate that employers in Central and Eastern North Carolina are beginning to put the thaw on pay freezes and give small merit-based salary increases, even as the economy is beginning to show new signs of strain. The number of companies freezing salaries is down, and the number of companies considering pay raises is up, according to the 2011 Wage and Salary Survey released by Raleigh-based Capital Associated Industries. The survey analyzes compensation trends of 500 companies. In 2009, nearly half of all companies froze pay. That figure was down to a quarter of companies in 2011 and is projected to drop to 19% by 2012. Those that are granting pay raises are upping salaries by 3% on average. That's good news compared to a few years ago, but not so great when compared to the past quarter century, points out Molly Hegeman, survey director at CAI. A decade ago, the average increase was about 4%. At first blush, a decline from 4% to 3% may not seem significant until it's considered that it's a 25% decrease. I think the 3% number may be the new norm, Hegeman says. At least that's what the data indicates over the past 3 years. CAI is headed by CEO Bruce Clark. Employees will earn those raises in a more merit-based way as opposed to annual cost of living hikes. We see more companies trying to differentiate based on performance, Hegeman says. Frankly, I think that's a good thing. Officers and executives are receiving the largest percentage increases to base pay at 3.48%, and companies are twice as likely to give a 4% raise to that category than to lower-level workers, according to the survey data. Also, high-level employees are far more likely to receive hiring bonuses, annual bonuses, retention bonuses, and stock option bonuses, the survey shows. Those bonuses are more likely to make up a larger percentage of overall compensation, too. Take chief financial officers as a case in point. The average bonus paid was $26,364, or an additional 18.6% of the average base pay of $144,977. In other jobs, a 4% bonus was more likely. Don't expect that pay structure to change anytime soon. I think variable pay will continue to be a focus, Hegeman says. The salaries report comes while the overall labor market seems unable to add more jobs than it sheds. The top five industries in the U.S. cut 66,414 jobs in July, while adding only 10,706, according to the latest report by Challenger, Gray & Christmas Incorporated, which has tracked the labor market since 1993. So far this year, the top five industries have shed 312,220 jobs and gained back 209,042. Last year, the U.S. lost 529,973 jobs in the top five industries. and added 402,638, according to the report. Although the news locally is positive, economist Jason Jolly doesn't want to read too much into it. Even with raises, people are just breaking even, says Jolly, a senior research director at the Carolina Center for Competitive Economies at UNC's Kenan Flagler Business School. The data led the CGC's CEO, John A. Challenger, to declare that the economic recovery has stalled and that a casual observer certainly might conclude that the wheels just fell off the recovery wagon. Hageman did not think the wages report signals any correlation to hiring. Companies are saying that they really can manage with fewer workers, and I don't see that changing in the foreseeable future, she says. And now I'm going to turn to the special report in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal on banking and finance. And the main article that starts off this section has the headline, Seismic Shift in Local Banking. Hello to PNC, Wells Fargo, ENC. Farewell to RBC, Wachovia, Gateway. This article is written by Lee Weisberger with a Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. And above the article, there are two pictures. The first picture on the left is of a man standing inside of a branch of a PNC bank. And the picture next to him is the large outside shot looking up at a large building, a PNC building. The caption reads, James Rohr heads up PNC Bank from the company's headquarters in Pittsburgh. A slate of new players and some old ones under new management will bring changes to the Triangle banking market by the opening months of 2012. Pittsburgh-based PNC Financial, which should be fresh off its $3.45 billion acquisition of RBC Bank USA during the first quarter, is expected to hit the ground running with a bundle of products aimed at different market sectors. Aside from its retail and business products, PNC also promises to push a new wealth management offering, dubbed Wealth Insight, aimed at higher-end customers, corporate clients, and nonprofits. It offers a range of services from brokerage to risk management to investing to retirement planning. PNC is one of the larger wealth managers in the country, the bank's CEO, James Rohr, recently told analysts, reporting that as of second quarter 2011, the bank's wealth management division had a total of $200 billion under management. That figure is up from the $108 billion level in 2010. PNC's takeover of 33 former RBC Bank USA Triangle branches promises to be one of the most dramatic market changes in store for the three-county region. Another will be when Wells Fargo moves to retire the Wachovia name at 78 Triangle locations, 45 in and around Raleigh and 23 in Durham and Chapel Hill. But the market alterations don't stop there. Significant changes also are in the works at the community bank level. New players that have already sunk tentative roots here are expected to push for more. Among them is High Point-based Bank of North Carolina, which is reporting good results after having opened a Raleigh office in 2010. Deposit and loan generation, the bank reported in its latest U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission filings, were well above plan, with a loan pipeline in the Raleigh location of over $80 million. And then there's an entirely new player, Engelhard-based ECB, which is buying four Gateway Bank-branded branch offices in the area and plans to build at least two additional branches within the next 12 months. Armed with $75 million in fresh capital from a private placement of the bank's shares, ECB wants to grow its assets from just under $1 billion now to $3 billion or more in 5 years. The Triangle market represents ECB's initial expansion experiment, and one of its first moves, says Chief Revenue Officer James Burson, will be to hire commercial bankers as we get our team in place. The bank expects regulatory approval for its entry into the Triangle by the fourth quarter of 2011. Not new to the area, but under new owners are two established community banks that will move forward with fresh cash and restructured loan portfolios. The takeover of Cary-based Crescent State Bank by Piedmont Community Bank Holdings, the Raleigh Investment Group, is slated to receive a go-ahead from regulators by the third quarter. The company's top executives are slated to remain in place after the ownership change, as will, for the time being anyway, the Crescent name. Piedmont CEO Scott Custer says he is continuing to scout out new targets as he builds an even larger bank holding company. Down the road, a name change could be in the works. Folded this year into a Southeast regional banking enterprise was Raleigh's Capital Bank, acquired in early 2011 by Charlotte-based North American Financial Holdings. Since the takeover, NAFH managers have infused the bank with new capital and cleaned its books of problem loans. Nearing profitability as of the end of the first quarter of 2011, Capital is expected to contend for business in the remainder of 2011 and into 2012. And our next article is written by Monica Chen with the Dayline of Durham. The headline, Florida Developer Files to Build Townhomes in Durham. A Florida-based developer is planning to invest about $35 million to build a townhome project in the NC 751 corridor of South Durham. The 169-unit project called South Point Trails has been proposed for about 28 acres at 8404 NC 751. It would be south of the St. Barbara Greek Orthodox Church on the west side of the highway, not far from the Chancellor's Ridge subdivision. South Point Trails developer is in the early stages of navigating the Durham City County Planning Department. A rezoning application has been filed to change the zoning from rural residential to planned development residential, and a petition for annexation into the city of Durham has been filed. Owner Jeff Gelman, through an entity called 751 LLC, purchased five parcels along NC 751 for about $3.12 million in 2006. Gelman, a former developer in Chicago who retired when he was in his 30s, lives in Hobe Sound, Florida. He says he has been vacationing in the Triangle for several years and originally purchased the land, which includes pastures and a farmhouse, as a getaway for him and his family. The property is in good location for development, Gelman says, since it's not far from the streets at South Point Mall. Plans for the property are in the preliminary stages of being drawn up. Robert Schunk with Hayden Stanzale is handling land planning and engineering. Gelman says he trimmed back from original plans to develop the property into a 300-unit apartment complex after hearing about another project called 751 South that has become mired in controversy. My lawyer came to me and said there was too much controversy with the other project, Gelman says, so we wanted to do a project that was less dense. We understand. We don't want to be in trouble. The area south of the mall in Durham is accessed by a rural scenic drive winding toward Jordan Lake. The 751 South project, no affiliation to Gelman's 751 LLC, was proposed by Southern Durham Development Incorporated to have 1,300 homes and 60,000 square feet of commercial space on 164 acres. The project incited a public outcry and debate over water, density, and sprawl, and has been stuck in court and the planning department for the past 3 years. Of the main partners of 751 South, Durham developer Alex Mitchell is auctioning off 34 condominiums at a separate development, The Landing at South Point, also located on NC 751. Another project that has been held up in the area is Jordan at South Point, originally planned for 125 acres on the boundary with Chatham County. Not all residents in the area are against further development along the highway. Steve Nicewarner, a real estate agent who has lived in South Durham for 17 years, says further development is a natural extension of South Point. And with our final minutes, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. New restaurants popping up around Triangle. A cornucopia of food choices are making plans to expand into shopping center and restaurant locations all across the Triangle. The Q Shack barbecue chain is on track to open its newest location in the food court at Crabtree Valley Mall sometime during the week of August 8. Jet's Pizza, which opened its first Triangle locations earlier this year, is getting ready to open a third location. Jet's will soon begin its $150,000 interior construction of its new 2,000-square-foot space at 6114 Falls of Neuse Road in the Northridge Shopping Center in Raleigh. Rick's Diner and Catering Company in Durham is making plans to expand again after relocating to 3710 Shannon Road in the Hope Valley Square Shopping Center in June 2010. A Southern Season sold to TC Capital. Chapel Hill-based A Southern Season has been sold to TC Capital Fund, which is headed by Chapel Hill entrepreneur Clay Hamner, for an undisclosed price. A Southern Season is a gourmet store that was founded by Michael Barefoot in 1975. Over the years, it has grown into a 60,000-square-foot emporium in University Mall and now has more than 300 employees. TC Capital Fund is a joint venture between two Chapel Hill investment funds, Carborough Capital Corporation and Trion Capital Ventures, LLC. The founders of Carborough Capital are Chapel Hill residents Clay Hamner, Betty Keenan, and Phil Phillips. The founders of Trion Capital are Pete Coker and Peter Richard. Seats go Wolfpack red at RBC Center. A seat replacement project at RBC Center is underway, something that will leave fans of North Carolina State University smiling. That's because the new seats are a different shade of red, one that Wolfpack fans will more readily identify with. It's definitely Wolfpack red, says John House, Centennial Authority CFO. The project includes 11,000 seats in the lower bowl and club level and 1,100 retractable seats behind the basketball goals. Those seats are folded up bleacher style for hockey games. Apple's iPhone faces new competition from RIM. In an effort to compete with Apple Incorporated and Google Incorporated, BlackBerry phone maker Research in Motion Limited announced Wednesday it is releasing five new BlackBerry smartphones. The new Bold 9900 and 9930 will have both a touchscreen display and the traditional BlackBerry keyboard. They will also be able to do near-field communications, which could facilitate mobile payments. The BlackBerry Torch 9810 will come with a bigger touch display and a slide-out keyboard. The 9850 and 9860 models will be touchscreen only and have bigger displays. They will all use the new BlackBerry 7 operating system. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.